We are disintegrated black, immune to referent, sediments spread by repeat burials, misunderstood continental drift, oceanic trench of record skip, we brutish notes, dogs of the omitted. We parent break into bop, conjugate the aphotic into a flawless pyre. Because what is funereal to the dead? We spin multiple graves simultaneous, new vinyl, speech across the deep, an ill language, ill suited to surface, misfit for any proper kind of sink.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
It is my great delight to introduce our first reader, Douglas Kearney, who will be gracing us with his poems this evening. Douglas Kearney has published 7 collections, including Optic Subwoof, the 2022 Griffin Poetry Prize winning collection Show, Buck Studies, winner of the Theodore Ruthke Memorial Poetry Award, the CLMP Firecracker Award for Poetry, and California Book Award Silver Medalist in Poetry. M. Robesse Philip called Kearney's collection of libretti Someone Took They Tongues a seismic polyphonic mashup. Kearney's Mess and Mess And was a small press distribution hand-picked selection that Publishers Weekly called an extraordinary book. Wire magazine calls Fodder, a live album featuring Kearney and frequent collaborator Val Ink as simply brilliant. Kearney is the 2021 recipient of Opera America's Campbell Opera Librettist Prize, created and generously funded by librettist/lyricist Mark Campbell. His operas include Suction, Mordake, Crescent City, Sweetland, and Comet Papaya. He has received a Whiting Writers Award, a Foundation for Contemporary Arts, Cy Twombly Award for Poetry, residencies and fellowships at Cave Canem, the Rauschenberg Foundation, and others. Born in Brooklyn and raised in Altadena, California, Kearney teaches creative writing at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and lives in St. Paul with his family. Please join me in welcoming Douglas Kearney to our virtual stage tonight.
Thank you very much, Natasha, for that introduction. Y'all, I'm just going to try to tell you like this. Like, you know, people call books or poetics that use this kind of approach an erasure, but I don't think that nails this. Like, this is forcing a kind of a permanence, a reminder of the existence of the document itself, even as it becomes a series of ships filled with black. So for real, y'all. Like, yes. All right. So thank you so much, Quentin, and congratulations again. I'm going to read a couple of perms that are sort of in the spirit as a way of sort of like laying down some blood on top of the water, I guess. This is called Eros, E-R-R-O-S. It is after Akilah Oliver and L.H. Stallings. And it's about perhaps a new kind of meaning from what would be Eros, E-R-O-S, but the mistake of calling it that. The whole premise is flaw. The hull, a wood prophylactic for aquatic wood. Can't you feel the motion of the ocean? We sing in millions of mouths. We go deep and sleepless, except it's all someone's wet dream. We are and we is grinding. I'll coin grind won't Google that for fear I've made nothing. I'm not afraid of nothing except making it. I don't want to conjure rats, but they're everywhere. When I nibble on my beloved's neck, how deep in her is screaming? Do you remember when we fell in? All the mid-tempos tell us rock. Can't you feel the motion? All the slow jams call us to grind. We grind. All the crunk slaps are fucking slavers. Tell me what to do. This isn't about history. My junk bounces athwart me even when I look over my shoulder. I will not conjure chains, but maybe the fuzzy kind from the sex shop. By chains, I mean cuffs. I'm not fuzzy about what chains are. This isn't about history. Outside, the ocean soaks the ship's wood on its progress. Whap, whap, whap. That's a wet-ass problem. Fat, fat, fat is the sound of hat skin. Any doc about slave ships or leaked sex tape. Any such sex tape, probably a snuff flick. The problem's not the wetness, all you fretting sexists. Is the Tafuna canoe exists. Is that the erotic isn't mine. As in, nigga. As in, Eros ain't my god. As in, I didn't dream a Gerber baby on the lube tube. Slippery. The next wave gets me wet. This isn't about the future. Kill in some black mouths is murder. Murder in some black mouths is stabbing. Stabbing in some black mouths is pitching. Can't you feel the motion of the ocean? Swells pitching the boat. Set a course for adventure. Sweetest reward. I am trying to get my genitals in order. They're down here in hors d'oeuvre. Some of it's mine. That shit isn't strange. Packed in tight. Somebody says, get it up. I'm next on deck to jump too. I drop and give them 20. My man don't like me letting myself go. Slap, slap, slap. Bend over to the front. Slap, slap, slap. Touch your toes. Slap, slap, slap. Get low. I go down in the hole. I'm a candlelit dinner. I'm an hors d'oeuvre and a little something sexy will get slept on in this romantic darkness. I am the dessert. Insert entendre before you come to consciousness. Can't say consummate without consume. We're grinded down to coin. They reach into their pockets and linger till they flip the money shot. The rats on my face. If I holler, rats in some black mouths, it's too dim to know whose name I better say. A fetish? A fetish floats a boat. God? Ships is christened in his. Won't pray to that, pray to that. Cruise? I can't trust the mouth that spits me out to kiss me, right? Earl's fuckery. Goddamn infants want to screw everybody. This isn't about history. All right, this next one is a brand new dance that's actually like a really old dance. It's a dance that maybe some of us might remember from like family reunions if you like go way way back in the family. And this poem is called "Do the Cruise Line Up Slow Grind Up."
Line up, everybody, for the rocking and rolling. You all in the group from the windows to the walls. Hook that back, bend them knees, grind in tight on the one you're with it down on the floor. In this funky ass joint to dawn till dawn. All next on deck, a new cut y'all ain't never heard, but the man on the wheel will make you move. That hot body from coast to coast. Who got the most soul folk want to hear y'all holler follow? These steps, if you step your best, not too fast, not too far, not too low. Might catch the blues on the one and three. Damn it, don't lose the rhythm. Gonna bring that beat back. Now, you know how my crew and I do this, believe that it's the law. Work it.
Finally, I'm going to conclude with a peppy poem about the middle passage. It's called Swim Chant for Nigger Merfolk. I just want to quote a couple of sources. There's Parliament, the funk group, not the governing body. Although in some ways, particular parliaments are sort of the source of this poem, when you think about it. I haven't thought about that before. Also, there's a quote from Disney's Little Mermaid. There's a quote from T.S. Eliot's Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and there is a quote from Robert Hayden's poem Middle Passage, because if you Google the phrase Middle Passage, you'll find a poem called Middle Passage. Pro tip. After that, I think there's one thing. There's mention of a duppy, and that's a particular kind of ghost from the Caribbean. Swim chant for nigger merfolk and aqua boogie set in lapis. Never learn to swim. Let me show, can die. Over a million ship, do wow wow. Over a million ship, do wow wow. Let your fish bone slip on man. 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 Oh, make a wish, be black fish. Make a feed, be black bleed. Base company. Coming, coming. Hammerheads, hammers head to ham, or head till hammer's fed. Oh, base company. Knocking, knocking. Great white jaw, great white jaw, jaw, juju. No. Duffy Duffy say, stay we in azure amber. Can't remember. Oh, they's company, hating. And all about was a darkening cloud, and the gullets filled with brine and kine. Cattle, chattel, charnel channel of a deep blue. See all about that darkening cloud, and the gullets full of water, and the gullets full of slaughter, assault. Assalto, charnel channel of a deep blue sea. Poseidon slides his foaming shroud ashore, no one will see.
Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more is you looking for? So sang a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the flow of silent seas. Oh, ye meager merfolk. A love song for song lovers. It'll all be fine. Finn. Fine. Oh, attention, nigger mermaids. Mermaid and merninnies. Chain like hooked and sink sardinies. Do not bleed in the sea. The stains won't wash out. We ancients responsible for your mess. Much abilge the management voyage through this company. Hatin', can't remember. Oh, this company, hatin', the stains won't wash out. Thank y'all very much. Thank you again, Quentin. Congratulations. Thank you.
Douglas, thank you so, so much for sharing that with us tonight. We appreciate you so, so much. Thank you for this offering. Once more to our audience, if you're interested in purchasing books by our readers tonight, links will be provided in the feed from all of our readers. Also, link to Ballast, our main attraction, will also be available there as well. Next up, I have the great honor and delight of getting to read two brief poems from my first poetry collection, Black Credit. It is currently in progress, so I'll be beginning our reading tonight with the collection's title poem. Also, ignore that quacking. That was my little timekeeper to myself, but it's fine. It's not part of the poem. So I'll be reading from the title poem of my collection tonight, Black Credit. Lord, your good daughter I have been my whole life. I've kept your house clean, a sucked bone, starved myself of everything your other children have told me is sin. I've sharpened my teeth on the slate of your word for your work's sake. Bridled the glint of my tongue so men will feel strong and not be seen trembling under the soft of it. I've behaved. And for what do I hunger? Myself growing slight on tomorrow's meat. Words, words, your words as valued here as black credit at an all-American bank. They say, Lord, piety is speaking to you, but madness is hearing you speak back. And under this, like all good jokes, lies the truth. No one in this equation seems to be listening anyway. To you, to our own damned selves. Tell me, how many black girls does it take to change a mind, or a home, or a block, or a scale? Or a heart, or a course, or a country. You, Lord, as you have with your other minor prophets, have dragged, or is it called us up the mountain, where in the thin air there are those who got here long before I ever dreamed of it, still waiting on you to finally cash this check. Next, I will be reading a poem titled Let My Anger Be the Celebration We Were Never Supposed to Have. That is a quote by the amazing, amazing St. Louis poet Jackie Germain. And I've thought of those words for years, and I owe the inspiration of this poem and its title to her. Let My Anger Be the Celebration We Were Never Supposed to Have. This will be my last poem. Thank you all so much for listening. America, you have left me on red more times than I can count, and yet I keep writing these texts to you, though you ghost me on the regular. Buzzed, I go to bed, and buzzing with expectation, each morning I wake up ready to do the same thing all over again, as though faith weren't something inherently crazy given the state of things. Lately, I've been making end times jokes, except they're not really jokes anymore. Who knew? The Book of Revelation is a documentary, and the sky really is falling, and the ocean is filling faster with the blood of everyone except those who spill it freely without guilt. America, this is what God told me about you, you field of dying sunflowers, you semi-automatic gunslinging unsanctuary, you apparition that is the crowd gathered beneath yet another oak tree on the postcard. Justice is not a pendulum. Justice is not a hammer. Justice is not a bandage. It is water. And your better angels have long sung of its rolling tide, calling those things which are not as though they were. Am I crazy, America, letting you inside me again and again and again and again and again, though you do not even love me, no matter how much I pretzel myself into something soft and edible enough for your salt slick tongue, America? I have lived in your valleys, and my shed skin is already buried in your ground. Night has fallen, America, and I am pulling your star down from the mountain. All right, thank you all so much for listening and for joining in. For any of you who may be tuning in now, we are here for the celebratory launch of Ballast by Quentin Baker. And we're going to be continuing this incredible night of poetry. It seems that right now our third reader, Marwa Halal, has not been able to tune in just yet. We're going to keep an eye out for her. But in the meantime, we're just going to move forward with the program. And so I have the great honor of getting to introduce our main reader for tonight, Quentin Baker. When I first met Quentin in 2018, it was at another celebratory assembly of poets. The Kaveh Kanem Fellowship Retreat was a space where brilliant Black writers came to write poems, workshop, build community, debate, laugh, cry, and sharpen one another. As was tradition, on the first night of the retreat, all the fellows took turns introducing themselves to the group and sharing what they hope to experience that week. It's been 5 years since that night, but I remember Quentin introducing themselves and single-handedly enchanting the entire room with their frankness, their wit, and a lighthearted self-deprecation that their thoughtfulness and sharp mind immediately belied. I remember that same week at the retreat, standing outside with Quentin on a bridge, hours into a lively discussion we were having about the ontology of Blackness beyond white supremacy or something like that. But what I do remember the most was Quentin sharing about the project they were working on at the time, a poetry collection about the only successful large-scale revolt of American-born enslaved people in 1841, the successful mutiny aboard a slave ship called the Creole. That project went on to become Ballast, the book we're all gathered here to celebrate now. Quentin Baker is many things, a poet, educator, a Kaveh Kanem fellow. Their expansive work and current focus reckon with Black interiority and the afterlife of slavery. Their work has appeared in The Offing, Jubilat, Vinyl, The Rumpus, and elsewhere. There were two-time Pushcart Prize nominee and the recipient of the 2018 Arts Innovator Award from Artist Trust. They were a 2019 Robert Rauschenberg Artist in Residence and a 2021 NEA Fellow. They are the author of This Glittering Republic and We Pilot the Blood. So much time has passed since that conversation with Quentin on the bridge, and even more time, research, and intense study and lots of artistic devotion have been poured into Ballast, this rigorous, beautiful, scholarly gift of imaginative ingenuity. Ballast is the work of a poet who loves the word and loves their people fiercely and without ceasing. But you don't have to take my word for it. Please join me in welcoming our reader tonight, Quentin Baker.
Oh, goodness. Thank you, Natasha. That was a very kind introduction, and thank you even more for not saying what I said in that circle, because you're not supposed to keep it a secret. We'll call it frankness. That's what we'll call it. It's truly just an honor to read with these folks. Thank you all so much for being here, and for lending your gifts and your talents. This is for me, this is a dream in a lot of different ways. So thank you so much. And thank you to Haymarket and everybody at Haymarket. This has been a process for me. It's been like 7 years. And y'all did so much for me. And bringing this book into the world, and I'm very, very grateful. So I'm just gonna read some stuff. There's not really gonna be any pauses. I just kind of read things from this book. The only thing that you need to know is that the redactions are from a Senate document in 1842 that talk about this revolt on the Creole. It has been impossible for me. The mutiny and murder of knowing. The criminal returned to desire. I am a crisis arrived. The body paid with the unusual knowledge of those taken, enclosed in a separate wound. I will not be the fulfillment of the object. The grave must be withdrawn. The sea, an outrage. Answer me. I am several boats filled black. I am several boats filled with longing. I am the sea. Filled and longing. I feel and object throughout. Had been the urge, and I delivered the wished copies, thought proper on arrival. We who pilot the blood. Returned as absence. So the second half of the book, or the second section of the book, is poems in an invented form. They're meant to be read omnidirectionally. So every time I read from the book, it's something different. So there's some of them I'll read in different directions. Some of them I won't. I never know until it happens. Every break in us is a treatise on the perfect, fragile design of being kept. The sail, tobacco leaf, night language of waves, tongues as parcel. Bless the island, bless the dim hum of unslaved, bless each blade we buried in a deserving belly. We are cargo born. Ballast, heavy with asking. And then what? We are disintegrated black, immune to referent, sediment spread by repeat burials, misunderstood continental drift, oceanic trench of record skip. We brutish notes, dogs of the omitted. We parent break into bop, conjugate the aphotic into a flawless pyre. Because what is funereal to the dead? We spin multiple graves simultaneous, new vinyl, speech across the deep, an ill language, ill suited to surface, misfit for any proper kind of sink. We brutish notes, thugs of the omitted, oceanic trench of record skip, misfit for any proper kind of sink. Ill-suited to surface, an ill language, we parent break into bop, conjugate the aphotic into a flawless pyre. A misunderstood continental drift, sediment spread by repeat burials, we are disintegrated black, immune to referent, speech across the deep, new vinyl. We spin multiple graves simultaneous because what is funereal to the dead? Black is open for empire. Black is ghost home, ghost ridden, is glitch at full speed. Black is rugged door hung on lying church, is matter of sick record. Black is leather, that leather is purse around silver. Black is almanac for exit wound. Black is blood authentic. Black is not new to a knower, is steed ridden to froth. Black is kicking open the jaws of ghosts to holler proof toward clip night, that long scream. Split and spilling in the middle, wave, water, ship, we build and swallow it all. Wet nurse to daggers and swaddling cloth. And then what? Still, yet we anthem toward altar. Under such ambulatory pressure, rhythm should be rendered impossible. Our nightmares fragment into law, redolent phylactery of shell and discard, the world attuned to the fragrance of overfed levee, a statute of preteen warded to the current. We delegislate latitude, envelop border in kink and curve, collapse the lungs to unlatch the hold. Our breath bends all barracoon skyward under red moon, chase lightning shattered through our entanglement. Whole anthology, our steps warn the dusk, lanterns at our hip, the whip burns an effigy of wound, rhythm should be rendered impossible under such ambulatory pressure, yet we anthem toward altar still. Look how far we come. What litany, what breach we bloom battle against. Blood don't run toward freedom, it just run. Literal, liturgical, a world-making emotion, mixture of bone and spirit, unguent for civil society. How many touch thumb to forehead in worship of distance from this watched flesh? What adroit steps we set as rigging. Blade and bullet we pull tight for sail, name whole, guide toward longer breath. Shadow in relief, a sharp wave made canonical through its breaking. And then what? Broken from out the middle. Combined, our mouths be the O and cog. Love in us, mechanized, bruised in blemish, kept and bled supremacy, black, and then blacker still. Blacker still, and then black supremacy, kept and bled, then blemish, bruised, mechanized, love in us, in cog, our mouths be the O. Combined, broken from out the middle. This ship is ritual improvisation. Worship built around skull shape and improvement. Rough hewn bone girding a beguiled world, perfect in its narrowing. We are drained to a permanent acre of open thorn, dense thicket of access and accumulation. We live through so much dark and distance, even the chronic collapse of nightmare is portal for origin. Model of the wound economy, we pull ourselves closed, chest flowering the most furious asylum, nation of rib spinal connectivity, languishing in a retrograde slap of waves emerging adorned in surf enough, even if only for ourselves. And so we shall continue. The perfection of discard, made to welcome any sudden fill, to wear exchange as a shining gown of silver wave, to no pleasure as unsigned promissory note. We play thief to our own silhouette language, hidden within midnight's unctuous gristle. In that shroud we can forget, we must forgive the blood before it spills. Golem, empty of speech, gilded by a filigreed absence, its brief float in the foam of offshore breaking, two hands clasped the most mellifluous shovel. To dig is beauty and circumstance, provide a name to drape over the chasmic wound. And then what? This ship deranges the sea. Every break and swell is rupture in mosaic, every step in anticipation of ordinance, a black on black collage of refusal. We cry out to salt, home in the non-place of non-being, beseech black ligature of waves to build us a new commons, move away from the dire selection of elective drowning. We do not rejoice in invasion preference or rebrand of prison logic. We are black along a breach axis, property birth enormous, uterine warehouse in a universe of escalation. Bullet hold the lash for when it see us, chimerical warden of the borderlands, willing architect of an obliterating literature. We keep time within a flagellated firmament of skull, beloved bone woven into ancestral garments, both of and to protect from a lacerating chronology. Both of and to protect from a lacerating chronology, beloved bone woven into ancestral garments, we keep time within a flagellated firmament of skull, willing architect of an obliterating literature, chimerical warden of the borderlands, bullet hold the lash for when it see us. We do not rejoice in invasion preference or rebrand of prison logic, uterine warehouse in a universe of escalation, property, birth enormous. We are black along a breach axis. We cry out to salt. Beseech black ligature of wave to build us a new commons, move away from the dire selection of elective drowning, home in the non-place of non-being, a black on black collage of refusal, every step in anticipation of ordinance, every break and swell is rupture in mosaic, the ship deranges the sea, and then what? Entire planets in the offing. risen from out the seas we mark as navigational. To remake the world is light work. We love in an ocean of intrusion. We birth and rear within miasma of bullet. Our most benign bops exude potentiality. Andromeda falls out of two-step. We dap after long absence and zoom toward sunflower. Come celebrate with us. On this steady bridge of knife and lash, we rejoice in our ordinary gait, our gifts given unto ourselves. What do we see except infinite inquiry? And then what? We lustral blood bearers, perfecters of spill, unkillable fugitive dead, our eluded flesh cleansed of every grope and clinch, our rack-weighted cot slashed and wrapped in asafoetida, black market of redress, we donate one another to ourselves, the proceeds of survival, assemblage in wave, the elision of the whole to occupy the badlands between break and escape, between breach and too much. Yes, we will cut the head off a snake, build panorama from its end, treat any scrap of planet like juniper seed. Treat any scrap of planet like juniper seed, build panorama from its end. Yes, we will cut the head off a snake to occupy the badlands between break and escape, between breach and too much. The elision of the hold, assemblage and wave, the proceeds of survival, we donate one another to ourselves. Black market of redress slashed and wrapped in asafoetida, our rack-weighted cots cleansed of every grope and clinch, our eluded flesh, unkillable fugitive dead, perfecters of spill, we lustral blood bearers. Thank you.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket. Our history has always been contraband, in defense of Black studies, edited by Colin Kaepernick, Robin D.G. Kelly, and Kianga Yamada Taylor. Since its founding as a discipline, Black studies has been under relentless attack by social and political forces seeking to discredit and neutralize it. Our History Has Always Been Contraband was born out of an urgent need to respond to the latest threat, efforts to remove content from an AP African American Studies course being piloted in high schools across the United States. Edited by Colin Kaepernick, Robin D.G. Kelly, and Kianga Yamada Taylor, this book brings together canonical texts and authors in Black studies, including those excised from or not included in the AP curriculum, as well as original essays by the editors and a range of scholar activists. Taken as a whole, these writings illuminate the ways we can collectively work toward freedom for all through abolition, feminism, racial justice, economic empowerment, self-determination, desegregation, decolonization, reparations, queer liberation, cultural and artistic expression, and beyond. Find Our History Has Always Been Contraband at haymarketbooks.org.
Incredible. Thank you so much, Quentin, for bringing this to us tonight, for that incredible reading. There's, I'm sure, lots of love and praise and questions coming through on the feed, so I'll be looking out for more of those before we go into our Q&A. I did just get word that Marwa should be able to join us. I believe she is trying to log in at some point soon, so I'm just going to keep an eye out for her. But in the meantime, I think what we can do is go ahead and start some of our conversation. When she's able to pop in, we could take a quick detour and hear some of her work, and then return to some more general questions for all of us as readers. But first, I would love to start off with a question for you, Quentin, on the heels of getting to hear from the collection, which again, heads up to everybody, get your copy of Ballast, especially after hearing it tonight. The book is nothing like what you've heard, and it won't be every single time you read it. It's something new every single time. But my question is for you, Quentin. So in the erasure portion of Ballast, there are several particularly subversive lines reckoning with the concept of the bodies of Black people as a form of capital. I'm thinking specifically of these lines. I'll just read them here. quote, "I have the honor to be a portion of the cargo lost to owners. I took place in transaction. We want ours now." So my question is, how do you as a poet and especially as the author of this book feel about the term Black bodies, especially in the way that it's often used today in the wake of public violence as a rhetorical substitute for Black people? There seems to be a very important distinction, but also I think a sinking of the two terms that I see in your work. And I'm curious to know how your process of writing this has informed how you think about this in a contemporary landscape.
Yeah, that's a good ass question. I think that, you know, all of my like thinking is definitely heavily influenced by Black studies and people like Christina Sharp and Sadia Hartman and Fred Moten and the endless other folks who are contributing to this field. So like when I think of the Black body and the separation from the Black person, I think of it as like an external, internal thing. Like Fanon talks about, you know, Black folks being overdetermined from the outside and, you know, like anti-Blackness and racism being a sort of uniform that gets put on you. So I think the body in that way is sort of this like ontological field where all of the nothingness and non-being of Blackness is held, all of the pain and all of the trauma and all of the sort of visible performance of nothingness that the human gets drawn around. That's like where the Black body lies publicly. And then of course, privately in our lives and our community and in the ways in which like we connect and are with each other, then our bodies are different. Our bodies are the human bodies. They're the bodies that are marked by survival. Our Black bodies are like, you know, the things that we hold and use to make a habitable world and an uninhabitable sort of society. So I think it's just trying to like honor that tension of like, to us, we are, of course, we're full human beings, we're alive and we love and we care for one another, but we're also hunted because of our bodies. So how do we theorize or think through that horrifying sort of, you know, obliterating reality? Like we live through this, but then also, yes, we live through this, some of us.
It's beautifully put. Just a quick follow-up to that. The word non-being comes up in the book quite a bit. You also just used it here in your explanation. Could you, you know, speak a little bit more to the audience in terms of what that word means to you, especially in the context of the book?
Yeah, so Black non-being is, you know, a concept that's been like iterated on and written about a lot. And so like my understanding of it is that try to keep this brief. Basically, like,
no need. We got time.
Basically, chattel slavery, like the act of the Middle Passage, took people with a history or a heritage and turned them into people like disconnected from anything. So like once you're loaded on that ship, you no longer have a language, you no longer have a lineage, you no longer have a family, you no longer have connections, you have been transmuted into property. And so that is a sort of like non-being, like you don't actually exist. You're only existing to hold space for like what is human, because it's very clear that you are not, because human beings are not objects. Like in the beginning of Moten's In the Break, it says, you know, like the history of Blackness is that, I'm paraphrasing, is that objects can and do resist. And so the Black non-being is just, it's there. It's just sort of a framework to attend to like, okay, what's the reality of when a group of people are turned into objects, literal, actual property objects? Like that's not being, that's not life, that's not living in some ways. So like societal. So really it's like a societal understanding of the position, the Black position, as one that is not, it's not participating in time as it's being understood by dominant people. It's not participating in society as it's being understood. Orlando Patterson called it social death. It's that sort of, and then people have theorized beyond that concept of social death to include just the sort of totality of non-being.
Thank you for speaking to that a little bit more. Would you say that in that sort of positioning, in terms of looking at like this, taking this historical view of Blackness as a position of being an object, how do you feel like you wrestled with that in writing these poems? Would it essentially mean that you had to inhabit the point of view of anti-Blackness as it is prevalent on a global scale in order to arrive to that place?
No, I think really, you know, it's a repudiation of it. I think like the way that I attend to it is just by inhabiting what I inhabit every day, which is Black interiority, which is like the lived lives of Black folks as we live and survive, and then trying to honor and recognize, you know, that not all of us live and survive. But basically just like, you know, the reality that any Black person is here alive in the year 2023 is stunning, given the history of chattel slavery or colonization or just global anti-Blackness. Like there are so many forces at work that require Black death. So I think for this book, it really was just like Sadie Hartman and Venus, Venus Sensu actually says that like, you know, there's no way to inhabit the slave position. There's no way you can't project that agency backward. You know, all you can do is look for echoes. And so I think that's like in the redactions, you know, that's what I try to do rather than inhabit something that I couldn't even conceive of. I can't, as difficult and as obliterating as anti-Blackness is today, it's still impossible to understand what it's like to live through chattel slavery. And so I never wanted to project agency backwards and like pretend that I could do that, but I can listen for the echoes that still play today. So that's why, you know, Sadia Hartman coined that term, the afterlife of slavery, in her book, How to Lose Your Mother, Lose Your Mother. And so that to me is really like, you know, like how it functions.
Thank you for that. We have questions pouring in from the chat. I see one here from Courtney Lamar Carlson. Courtney's question for you, Quentin, is, I'll just read it here. It says, the ability to read omnidirectionally is incredible and shows such a mastery in craft, but also intense care. Why was it important to you to invest that time, energy, care, and concern?
Thank you, Courtney. Also, what up, gang gang? I think, you know, so for me, yeah, the omnidirectional reading and the invented form, like I thought of it and think of it as like a way to pay homage to the polyphony of Black life and Black voices. Like Blackness is infinite, the permutations of how Black folks live and exist and survive in the world and thrive in the world. And as you know, like, it's endless. So I thought that like, you know, having poems that could be read in any direction would be a small way to try and honor that, to say that like, you know, we say it all the time, like Black folks are not a monolith, but it's just, what would that look like to be represented? And I also see it as a repudiation of the slave coffle. Like in doing research, I came across a lot of images of slave coffles, and it always just made me like extra irritated. Like when you're reading about this stuff and like, you know, dealing with it, it's always irritating. But the concept of the slave coffle is like moving people from inland to the ships where they can be sold, or to the slave auctions. Like they would chain people up in specific order. So the most able-bodied people would be chained around their necks and arms and feet. And then like, you know, usually women or children would be sort of like in a loose packing. So I just thought that like having this sort of omnidirectional like ability to zoom out in any mode, to me, it just like personally was like a repudiation of the slave coffle of like, we can move in any direction we want to.
Easily put. I've got one more question for you, Quentin, before we take a brief pivot. Mara has been able to join.
Yay.
Here, Mara, glad all is well. And so we're going to do a quick little pivot and rewind the clock a little bit so we can hear some of her work, and then we can continue the Q&A / conversation. This is a conversation in my for. A question directed to you specifically, Quentin, from the feed. This is from Drew Barker. They said, when researching, when do you know your cup overfloweth and the words are ready? Oh, I like that question.
you know, I was at Convict Condom, and Robin Costa Lewis gave her like a presentation on her work in the archive around Voyage of the Sable Venus. And I think somebody asked her when she knew it was done, because she was working on it for like 10 years or a really long time or whatever. And she was like, I knew it was done because it was going to kill me. And like at the time I was like, Robin, you're exaggerating. But now I'm like, Robin, I understand. So yeah, like really honestly, like that was at the point where I was like, I feel like my physical like health is suffering. Like this is, it's just a hard thing to let, you know, to be totally inhabited by for, you know, like worked on this for like 7 years. So like, yeah, I think, honestly, yes. Once I realized it, I was like, this is hurting me more than it's helping me now.
There's a connecting question also from the chat. So I lied. I'm going to ask you one more. This is from Karina Brosman, and they said, Have you felt a visceral connection to the humans who were on the Creole? How have you experienced that?
So I think like the thing about the afterlife of slavery is that, yeah, like it all echoes. You know, like when I was working on this, it was like I started working on this in 2015. And I don't know if y'all remember, but there was a case in Oklahoma with a police officer named Daniel Holtzclaw, who was using his position as a police officer in traffic stops to rape black women, poor black women who couldn't afford to, you know, come out to him in court or didn't have a platform to speak because they were poor black women. And as I was reading about this case, I'm also doing research on the Creole. And on the Creole, they had this practice, which was not uncommon, of called ship wives, where the white crew members and the first mate would take women, enslaved women, into their cabin. And usually it was like young. And on the Creole, there was a girl, she was 15, named Mary, who was one of these ship wives. So I'm reading these things simultaneously. And, you know, when you map the frequencies over one another, like whatever Mary and those women, you know, who were ship wives, whatever they had to do internally to survive, to like mentally continue moment to moment, is not going to be very different from what the women in Oklahoma had to do moment to moment to survive the millions of Daniel Holtzclaws that they encounter. So, you know, that sort of just like these things aren't the same, but they're not different enough for people not to be suffering and have to find these internal strategies of surviving like just pure horror.
Those echoes continue, as you said. Well, thank you so much. We're going to come back to some more questions in a bit. But first, I would like to pivot to Marwa Hillel, who's been able to join us. Marwa, if you'll share a few poems with us. But first, I would love to introduce you. So Marwa Hillel was born in Al-Mansura, Egypt. She is the author of Antibody, Invasive Species, the chapbook I Am Made to Leave, I Am Made to Return, and a Belladonna chaplet. Hillel is the winner of BOM Magazine's biennial 2016 poetry contest and has been awarded fellowships from the Whiting Foundation, New York Foundation of the Arts, Jerome Foundation, Poets House, Brooklyn Poets, and Cafe Canem, among others. She has presented her work at the Museum of Modern Art, the Studio Museum in Harlem, the Brooklyn Museum, and the Guggenheim Museum. Please join me in welcoming Marwa to the stage to read.
Hey, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Thank you so much for the grace. I am so sorry. I got lost in both West Coast time and kid time. I was playing with my niece, and next thing you know, it's time to do this. So congratulations, Quentin. It's so good to celebrate you and this phenomenal work. These questions really show the attention you've given this work reflected back to you. So it's like, it was very nice to walk in to that. And Douglas, Natasha, Erica, Haymarket, you know, just thank you for the space and gathering us. I can't wait to talk more. So I'm just going to read a couple of poems in celebration and in honor. This is, the poem is a dream telling you it's time, is a field, as long as the butterflies say it is a field with their flight. It takes a long time to see, like light or sound or language to arrive and keep arriving. We have more than six sense dialects, and I am still adjusting to time, the distance and its permanence. I have found my shortcuts and landmarks to place where I first took form in the field. That's kind of a joke on myself, though. It's like, you know, time, here we are in time. So good to share time, but more importantly, space, and be alive at the same time as all of you working against time and all the ways that capitalistic time is killing us. This is the days is numbered. Startling semi-annual saccharine sensitivity to sentencing in a season of severing and severances to so-called civil servants of stretchery and separation. I sense a series of spectators or investigators won't save us like stolen generators. Nothing speculative about spectacles. We beasts spit and sputter, spits and sputters, splitting sutures of your occipital up your occidental, skeptical of this spectacular softness of this plexus flex. I choose the best for myself. Swearing the swivel of the stank of spangled smear with speared wet spirit spent to coalesce in this nonsense. That's the thing about your language, is I make it sound so good it doesn't have to make sense. They is all what you is, where you from. Someone tell these oxymorons we is dual citizens, former resident aliens, and we have only just begun counting down this society's days with the efficiency of Arabic numerals. Thank you.
Amazing, amazing. Marwa, thank you so much. And again, we're so glad that you were able to join us and be a part of this conversation. Timing of it worked out beautifully in the long run. Next on our docket, going back to some questions, I have a question from our very own Erica Foreman, and it's a question for everyone here tonight. Erica said, there's a thread between your works and how you are deliberate with language. What's the relationship between dismantling, recovering, and creating something new as you engage language with your work? Any one of us may respond to this, / all.
I mean, I think a lot of my work connects to, you know, the kind of processes, the rhetorical technology of signifying. And signifying oftentimes mobilizes irony at the same time that it's mobilizing pun, at the same time that it's mobilizing the question of whether the person has mastered the language or whether they're making mistakes. And all these things, like, destabilize people who don't have the ability to discern what is noise and what is signal. You know, a really simple example is, you know, when people say, you know, this is an old one, it's really like the common one. It's like, oh yeah, he bad, or she bad, or they bad. Like, the language says one thing while the intention says something different. And I think that there's something about dismantling that when you use those techniques, there is a kind of a dismantling, sort of a detaching the assumed sense from the sense you are making. I think there is a way to kind of overload language, which can create a kind of the multiplicity of meaning that we see in Quentin's final section. One of the things that came to me as I was listening to them read was, as I would look through the pages, oh, which one are they reading? Every time my eye fell on a piece of syntax, even if it was from a different poem, it fit right in between. So there's chorus even beyond the individual pages, right? Even beyond the individual reader, there is communal chorus there. And that, in some ways, like, when does the poem stop? The poem just keeps generating and keeps generating and keeps generating. We can mathematically determine how many poems there are, but but it's more than a civilization could read. And there's something about that that is dismantling. What happens when a line is repeated, right? That's not redundant. It's amplification, it's transformation. So to me, that kind of sense of like dismantling with care is to actually show how much in a poem like that, how much agency you as a reader has, how often you are participating in a particular ordered reading, but how much actual agency you have whenever you pick up any text or any form of media. How can you engage that and participate in a dismantling, re-membering, you know, in all of those different kinds of ways. So that's a way that I was kind of thinking about that, especially in relationship to Bounce.
Yeah, I feel like, first of all, thank you. That's generous. And I think that I really, you know, me and Mara did a reading at CAP in Pittsburgh, and we talked about something similar, but I'm interested in like language that where we can't be followed. That's what's always made me feel gathered in is when I'm reading language that I know only the people that love us can follow us there. So like for me, it's really about de-hooking, unhooking language from certain semiotic agreements or discursive agreements within the wide imagination. Like there's so many levels to like languages. English is and all like all colonial languages are like so instrumental in the project of anti-blackness and like in the project of dominating black folks. And like so like when in time a black person gets killed by the police, someone's always reaching for a waistband. So now you've got reaching and waistband like in this sort of lexical you know, like armament. So really for me it's about like how do you clean that, how do you take it away into something that we can make just for us. And so, you know, like people like Doug or people like Fred Moten or people like Harriet Mullen, like, you know, I see this is like a cleaning of language. And like I'm reading this and I'm like, this is new. This is clean. There's nothing here that's killed me before. So I can be, I can rejoice in this. So yeah, I think just trying to, you know, attend to that project, and I think like historically, like Gwendolyn Brooks and Amy Cesare are doing that. Just like you can't bring anything to it except what they're bringing out of it. And that makes it, you know, feel safe and dangerous simultaneously.
Oh, I love that. Safe and dangerous all at the same time. I'm happy to also answer the question too. I'm mostly focusing on the idea of recovering and creating something new in language, that part of the question. It's something I've been reckoning with for, you know, the entirety of my fairly young writing life so far, about that injunction, you know, that Ezra Pound kind of got on his high horse and said, make it new. Then you put that up against, you know, some ancient wisdom that says there is nothing new under the sun. And then what do you do with that paradox? And so for me, in part because of the religious considerations of my work, as well as the racial considerations of my work, which for me are personally very, very deeply intertwined, I found myself thinking about making not so much as rearranging the language that I already have, but language as a means of invoking in terms of making something new. So for me, I've been thinking a lot about how poems to me are all poems to me, quite frankly, they're all prayers. They're either invocations for something that is desired, they're prophesying something that is yet to come, they are echoes of the past, but they all operate in this, I think, metaphysical, and for me, a very deeply spiritual space of calling something down that hasn't been imagined just yet. I tend to think of prayers as spells as well. And so I think about how in choosing our language specifically, particularly in choosing my language, particularly I'm always thinking about what is this going to evoke, not just in my reader or in myself or in someone that I'm talking at in the poem or someone that I'm speaking to in a poem. I'm looking at how bringing that poem into being is creating a portal for something divine to kind of pour itself in. And I think that divinity looks very, very different from time to time. Sometimes it is in something that feels completely inexplicable and, you know, you can call it a miracle if you want. Sometimes it's just the voice of a beloved. Sometimes it's the voice of a friend. Sometimes it's the voice that you can't really pin down or name, but you know it's kind of real. Like, poetry to me seems like an opportunity to do a lot of calling down. And that feels like a pretty, it's pretty weighty and dangerous responsibility, right? Because you have to think about what it is that you are bringing into the universe, your universe, the world of your poem. But it's all spell work and prayers to me, every bit of it. It's all hexes and blessings, and I love it all.
Beautiful. I love that. Actually, I was reading Bring Back Our Girls the other day at the Festival of Books here. And somebody actually, like, did a woo, like a holler, like a supportive holler at the word hex. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. That has never happened. But yeah, and I wonder what everybody's understanding of, you know, that metaphysical time space calling in is, but that's not really necessary for the work. It's just the work is better with that awareness, absolutely. But I also have kind of a question, which is, like, I love what Quentin said about the language of not being followed, right? Like, finding language that we cannot be followed into, and preferably out of as well, right? But so often that gets called illegibility. And like, I don't know if it's like the English as a second language chip on my shoulder, but like, I really have a problem with that. So like, I don't know if anybody has any consolation or like why so often are we agreeing to illegibility? Because I'm like, bro, like, no, this is like, it's the anti-language, right? Mm-hmm. This is the language that came before your language. Like, that's my source. So I don't know. Does anybody have a response to that? Because I would love to understand. Like, I really don't understand this language.
The question to me is, illegible to who?
Yeah, I mean, that's when I was thinking about noise versus signal. I mean, like, people assume that something is just noise, but it's actually signal. And illegible also makes possible the idea of hiding in plain sight. And like, of course, a person might be like, I don't want to hide shit. I'm like, I'm here. This language is a monument, right? It's not a whisper. It's the weather itself. But that desire, the way I think of the desire to craft a language that can't be followed is like, how do you delay the hounds that are coming to consume and metabolize whatever it is you've made into something that is no longer poisonous to, you know, a cultural idea? I mean, like, so there's, you know, there's one thing you can sort of think of, like, eat this now, like, I'm giving it to you and it's poisonous, but enjoy that shit, right? But there's this kind of sense of delay, you know, to not be found, because in the same way that you're talking, Natasha, about like illegible to whom, it's like, who's following, like, who is following you, right? You know, and I mean, sometimes we can think about that, you know, with the complexity of like generationally, like when does a younger person leave a trail that an older person can't follow because of legibility, as you put it, Marwa? Like, how do we create a house that's also simultaneously a trapdoor? without dropping everybody out of it. Like this constant kind of a sense of like doing that architectural work within the shape shifting of the language, or even just the shape shifting of sound. Right. Like, so to me, that's, so I don't know if that eases or like makes it, or like, but I think that there is something about this idea of there is work. Okay. All right. There is work that acts like the jungle porter in all of those very terrible racist films where, like, you know, the imperialist colonialist, like, finds someone from locally. And that person, like, exactly, they have the machete, and they're like, this way, Indiana, this way. And I'm going to take you to the temple, and then I'm probably going to die, right? But you are going to become the new lord of the temple, right? So there is language that acts as porter, right? That acts as guide into the hidden space, right? But what is the language that misdirects? What is the language that says, oh, I'll take you there, and you take them to a cliff? What is the language that says, oh, I'll take you there, and, you know, they wake up the next morning with all their shoes and, you know, watches gone, and they tied up in the trees? Like these kinds of approaches, you know, if there is a place that the language can take us to, then the possibility, of course, is that that is a place that can be found. What you said about hex and what Natasha says about spells, like, that creates the possibility of a place that might not actually be reachable just by following these words. Right. So I love that question. And I love kind of pushing back on, you know, the delight I think of in, like, hiding in plain sight by thinking about, like, why hide? Right. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that question and where it has me thinking.
No, it reminds me of something that you say, Quentin, in the afterword of your book about wanting to do violence to the text that you're erasing. That I thought that was just absolutely an incredible way of phrasing it. And it makes me think about this in connection to Marwa's question about this idea of illegibility. How do you feel like that played into the act of erasure for you, but specifically that framework of wanting to hurt this text, which I've never heard someone frame an erasure so explicitly as that, and I loved it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I take Fanon to heart sometimes, you know, and he said that the world was made through gratuitous violence and it must be unmade through gratuitous violence. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you encounter a text like that, it's violent. And so sometimes, you know, the only way you can crumble the structure is to take a hammer to it. And I just, you know, and I wanted to attend to the emotion that I felt, like, most, you know, predominantly, which was rage, like, rage at law of speech. And also, like, so, like, on the Creole is 135 people, and there's no like, no one ever talked to them or recorded anything that they ever said. But then there's also the layer of, depending on who it was talking to them, or just in general of being recorded in a public way, whatever they said would have been under arrest in a way. So, like, for me, it was, the rage was like the reality that their speech was, it was impossible to record, like, as they experienced it. The only way to have recorded it was to have been talking to them face to face, because of the perils, because of the pressures. And I mean, this comes up with, like, you know, when they would record former slaves after, like, manumission, and it was, you know, like, white people talking to them. And it's like, people want to use that as evidence. All it is evidence of how Black people would talk under duress to someone who, you know, holds their life in their hands. So, yeah, I think, and that also is a type of illegibility. It's like, when you read those slave narratives or the recordings of those conversations, like, if you know what they're saying and not saying, then you're understanding something very different than what an abolitionist is going to read, or, you know, someone who wants to drum up support for Reconstruction, whatever. Like, so there's layers to it. And, like, you know, Joe was talking about, like, ironizing and puns. Like, there's all these different ways and pathways to occluding and obscuring, or just misleading, misdirect. you know, trickster spirit, whatever it might be. But for me, it was violence. I was just angry, which I think is, you know, valid too, as a response. But
absolutely, absolutely. Kind of continuing that thread of, you know, looking at these historical records of violence, I had a question for you, Quentin. Balanced appears to be in conversation with a lot, but particularly another powerful predecessor, M. Nabese Phillips' poetry collection, Zong. For anybody who may be unfamiliar with that book, Zong is a poetry cycle composed entirely from the words of the case report for a landmark insurance fraud case in 1781, predicated on the massacre of 130 enslaved Africans aboard a ship of the same name. So Quentin, is this a book that you wrestled with at all while you wrote Ballast, particularly as it involves elegies for Black people who have been silenced both by physical violence, historical violence, and the passage of time?
Definitely. You know, Zong is like sort of an unimpeachable text. You know, it was so important for me. I had started writing the book before I ever heard about Zong. And someone was like, yo, you read Zong? And I was like, nope. And then I started reading and I was like, oh, I guess I fucked up by not reading this first. My little dumbass ideas. Like, she, I thought I was doing something like interesting, but no. You know, she already crushed the game. So, you know, like I think we're doing different things, but definitely, like, if anyone thinks of my book when they think of Zong or puts them together, like that's the highest possible praise. Like, but you, like, so I had to read it. I had to read it and understand it. And she, of course, is so generous. And like, there's a whole appendix that talks about her process and talks about, like, you know, her approach. And so it was just, like being able to have that as like a guide, you know, was super, super, super helpful. Like, it was just everything to me. And also it was like, okay, like, yeah, I do. We're doing different things in some ways, but I also, yeah, I want to be in conversation with this book because it became such an important and vital, vital book for me. But yeah, and then the fact that we both ended up with like sort of these texts that can be read in different ways, like I honestly like had already like started doing that, and then she did it, and I was like, damn, I'm really, she got me covered, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm trying to drive left, she cut me off. I'm trying to go right, she cut me off. I got to step back, nope, she covered that too. But yeah, just the expansiveness of her work and like the care that she had, I was like, If I don't do anything else, I need to match that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I do think that the books are very much speaking to each other and belong together on the same shelf. So I'm just going to go ahead and say what all of us are thinking. These works are very much in conversation. You can make a face if you want, but these books are in conversation.
I will.
We have another question for the group. We also, I'm just keeping track of time. We have about 10 more minutes left. But here's a question for the group. In this moment of book bans and rewriting history, how has your relationship to tending to the record changed or clarified?
I think, speaking for myself, I mean, ain't nothing different, really. Like, it's always been the same thing, you know. Nobody ever gets tired of trying to forget about or disappear Black folks from history, from present. You know, you could, whether it's the 80s and all the Black girls they didn't want to find in Atlanta, or the today and all the Black girls they didn't want to find in Memphis, or like what, like, you know, there's no, like, it's funny. I think there's moments nationally or globally that sort of heighten these things for everyone. And then Black folks are always like, well, that's already been happening. That shit, okay. Like, it sucks when there's extra laid on top, always. It's just added burden, added stress. But, you know, we've been surviving through all different types of violence and erasure, state sponsored and otherwise. So really, it's just another bullet to dodge.
Yeah, I tend to think about news cycle, media attention as like a great big mixing board and like dimmer switches on that. So like there's a baseline that's always going do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, and it's always there. It's just that national attention might be like to drive that one down to it's really quiet or silent. But we're still hearing it, right? We're still hearing it and feeling it. And so like when that dimmer switch gets pushed up, that just means suddenly this kind of feat of engineering, social engineering, is saying, hey, pay attention to this now. And, you know, there are lots of reasons to ask the question, why did this go up now and why did this go down now? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's constantly happening. As Quentin said, you know, it's the changing same, as Amir Baraka might have put it. Yeah, it's just the changing same. And so one level, I mean, there's this moment, this passage in Ballast, you know, this obliterating literature, right? Like that, when we talk about flexibility and motility, right? Like it's an obliterating literature. It's a literature that obliterates. It is also the literature of obliteration, right? Like, so that isn't precarity, it's shape-shifting and transformation. And so we can think about access to the archive in a similar sort of way. You know, these archives never meant to collect all of our books anyway. So sometimes where you gotta go is to, you know, mom and them down the street to their garage. That's an archive too, right? So like, you know, I think that, I don't think I'm saying anything though. I just wanted to quote obliterating literature because that shit is dope.
Yeah, I mean, I feel very represented by these answers. And, you know, I worked as a journalist before switching to poetry, and like the journalists supposedly setting the agenda is actually what led me here. Cause it's just like, you know, those questions of like, well, why are you dialing this up? Why are you dialing that down? Why are you using that photo? Why are you using the word allegedly? Why, you know, you can go on and on and on. And they actually don't care about the language they use. They just don't. The only thing they care about is not getting sued. This is really what it comes down to. And so, you know, like if I can make art that serves all the purposes that journalism doesn't, then that's a win. That feels good, you know? So.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. Yeah, I keep thinking about this idea of ending a record in terms of posterity and what that means, particularly in a time that feels, you know, apocalyptic. I've been thinking and writing a lot about this idea of living in a apocalypse and what that has meant to many, many, many previous generations who all believed they were in an apocalypse, and it was 100% true for them as well. This got me thinking about how, gosh, I guess it's been 5 or 6 years now when the TV adaptation of Handmaid's Tale, you know, came out, and there was a lot of discourse going on about it. I just remember feeling this very strong disconnect from a lot of the discourse I was seeing on Twitter at the time, because I was seeing a lot of people, especially, you know, a lot of white women saying like this was like truly chilling and like so horrific, and it's, you know, so true to the book, and et cetera, et cetera. And as I was watching, all I could think was, this is just showing white women going through the exact same thing that Black women and Indigenous women and Asian women and Latinx women in this country have all experienced at various points in history. The only thing that is different here is that it's a white face that you're seeing this time. This is not an apocalypse. I mean, maybe it is, but our apocalypse has been happening. And so what happens if you see yourself as, you know, in whatever kind of end of the world mode it feels like you're in, and, you know, in the generation that you're living in? But I also find myself with that. I see myself reckoning with that. I just left a little note saying the end for who. I think that's so right. What does this mean for those of us who are experiencing this for the first time in our lives? But we can look to the historical record and see that not only has this happened before, it has happened before many, 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 many times. What makes our time so different, other than technology and nuclear warfare and all that other great stuff? But I think it's been a challenge for me to think about what kind of record I am leaving or hoping to preserve when everything feels like it's in such a state of precarity anyway. And so I just find myself looking to those who came before me. You know, I'm living in the future that maybe they didn't think could even be possible. And so if I'm going to have the strength and willpower and mental health to even sit down and write a damn poem in the first place, I need to remember that there were other people for whom the world was very literally ending for them, and they survived, and they wrote, and they loved, and they fought, and that it's possible to continue. So that's really where I've kind of been falling on that question. You know, it feels kind of strange to think about what a record can look like for the future, but I'd like to think that there will be one. All right, we have one more question. This is a question from the chat by Joel Diaz Porter. It's a question for Quentin. Can Quentin talk about the Clifton riff and any other quotes/riffs that we may have?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Shout out DJ Renegade. There's like a couple of direct quotes. So like, I think in the one that I read was, we are not new to the knower, which is a quote from Baraka. And then the Clifton Rift is, you know, come celebrate with us on the steady bridge of knife and lash. And, you know, I mean, Clifton is just, I started as a rapper. So for me, like, you know, homage and lines that are like adapted and like, that's to me is like just a sign of respect and appreciation. Like, I think about that Clifton poem. I think a lot of people think about that Clifton poem all the time. And it's also like a shorthand, you know, like I think when a black person who reads poems sees come celebrate with us, or come celebrate with me, like, you know, so it's carrying context within it. And that's the context that I wanted to tap into, in that moment, in that poem. So, but yeah, just for me, it's just like, it's like sampling. Like, there's a line from Norbese Phillip in the poem. There's a line from Gwendolyn Brooks. There's a line from Nathaniel Mackey. So, you know, these, it's just a way for me to pay homage to folks.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful. And I can't think of a better way to close out the evening than with that remembrance of homage, of praise, of gratitude, for all those who got here long before we ever thought about it. Quentin, thank you. Thank you so much for your gracing us with your work tonight. My thanks to our readers as well. Doug and Marwa, thank you so, so much for your generosity and the brilliance of your work. Thank you to our audience who brought in such fire questions and were a part of this evening. Just a reminder once more, you are looking to support our poets tonight. You can. There are links in the live feed. Also, make sure that you follow these poets and their various capacities. There's Twitter and Instagram and all of that good stuff. So be sure to follow and support our writers today. Thank you all so much for your time, and go forth and have an incredible evening filled with poetry. Good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.